College students are struggling to find Christ in a culture that rejects God. They need the Christmas message of hope and truth now more than ever. Thanks to a generous matching gift, every dollar you give to the Thomistic Institute before December 31st will be doubled, so your gift will touch twice as many souls. You can give the greatest of all gifts by sending the light of Christ to students aching for truth. Please use the link below or go to ThomisticInstitute.org/donate to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So what we're going to speak about tonight is a little bit of history and a little bit of philosophy. Okay, it's going to take us more or less. The plan, at least, is 45 minutes, and then there'll be about 15 minutes for questions and answers after that. But that's all right. So, what difference did Christianity make? Why the ancient Greeks, Romans, and Irish converted? So, what I'm going to speak tonight is nothing original in that sense. It's more or less known already, but hopefully we'll put things together to make them presentable to you as well. And if you're not familiar with the subject, then hopefully digestible as well. So the first century, what we call the first century of the Common Era, or as Christians we might call it, the first century of the AD, the year of our Lord, was in many ways the greatest century of the Roman Empire. So the Roman Empire had begun to come to full fruition in the first century BC, right? You get, in particular, the great figure of Virgil, for example, in literature. You get the Emperor Augustus in particular bringing an end to all the civil wars. And bringing an end to all the civil wars, he brought peace. Okay, so now he brought peace by hammering his enemies, but he brought peace nonetheless. And this allowed the empire to stabilize. You get quite a few great works of art from this time still. In particular, in Segovia in Spain is one I'm thinking of, a great big aqueduct that was still in use until recent times, and an incredible piece of engineering. So something that's lasted 2,000 years almost in its work. The empire was still expanding through the first century. Okay, so often decay sets in before you notice it. But in the first century, the Roman Empire was still expanding. So it was still in its most glorious age and was going to expand, keep on expanding until about the year 117, when it reaches its maximum length. It goes from the Persian Gulf in the Far East, all over the way over to the west of Spain, and northwards to Britain as well. So a gigantic empire. Now, nonetheless, the most far-reaching result of the first century Roman Empire is none of these things, not the Emperor Augustus, not the works, not the expansion or the army, but a religious movement that exploded in the first half of the first century in Palestine and hurtled across the Roman world and became extremely prominent extremely quickly. So, as a Christian, we would say that one of the major reasons for this is the power of the Holy Spirit, right? That God infused himself into people's hearts and minds, okay? But this talk is not going to look at that. It's going to look at it from a more human point of view and to see what people might have found attractive in this that caused them to convert in such great numbers. So your first quote there on your handout, I hope you all have a handout, is... As you see there in the, just at the very end of it, it's by an historian by the name of Tacitus, right? Tacitus is writing sometime around the beginning of the second century, and he's writing about an event that took place in the year 64. So Tacitus was himself involved in the Roman administration, the imperial administration, and he wrote the annals of the various emperors. And when he writes about Nero, he speaks about Nero, who's quite mad. And Nero burnt the city of Rome so that he could relay it according to his own plans. Now, do you think the people of Rome were happy with this? No, they weren't. And they blamed Nero, naturally. They knew that Nero was behind it. right? Nero tried to persuade them that, no, he hadn't done anything wrong whatsoever. So Tacitus takes it up here. He says, consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty, that is, crucifixion, during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their centre and become popular. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then upon their information, an immense multitude, multitudo ingens, for the Latin scholars there, was convicted not so much of the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind. Okay, so Tacitus, as you see, was not very well disposed towards Christians, right? That's not so important for us. What's important for us is that he says that in this time, just about 35 years or so after the death and resurrection of Christ, there's already a huge number of Christians in Rome. All right? So you see how this religious movement is absolutely expanding incredibly rapidly. The second quote there is from another historian, Suetonius, who once again, just like Tacitus, writes histories of the Caesars. And he says this, he puts something a little bit earlier, but we might pass over it. I'll tell you why in a second. He says, since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he, Claudius, the emperor, expelled them from Rome. Okay, so now this is actually the year 42. So this would be within 10 years, you could say, of the death of Christ. And there are already riots in Rome. Now, what we don't know here is Suetonius actually referring to Jesus Christ, or is he just referring to a Messiah of some type? All right. So the second quote there, and that is from Acts of the Apostles, where St. Luke speaks about Aquila and Priscilla, two Jews who also were expelled from Rome. So it gives a little corroboration to both of them there. Right. So around the same time as Tacitus was writing, so that's to say around the year 110, more correctly, I think about the year 112, another man is Pliny the Younger. He's the Roman governor of the province of Bithynia, which is today northwest Turkey. Okay, so that part of Turkey that's across in Asia, but across the Bosporus from Istanbul. Okay, so he's the governor there. And he writes to the emperor Trajan, looking for advice on how to treat the Christians. And he says, you don't have it all there, but I'm just going to read you a little bit to give you a sense of what his letter is about. He says, it is a rule, sir, which I inviolably observe, to refer myself to you in all my doubts. For who is more capable of guiding my uncertainty or informing my ignorance? Right? So he's looking to the emperor for advice on this question. And the question is how to treat the Christians. So he says, having never been present at any trials of the Christians, I am unacquainted with the method and limits to be observed either in examining or punishing them, whether any difference is to be made on account of age, or no distinction allowed between the youngest and the adult, whether repentance admits to pardon, or if a man has been once a Christian, it avails him nothing to recant, whether the mere profession of Christianity, albeit without crimes, or only the crimes associated therewith, are punishable. In all these points, I am greatly doubtful. Okay, so he says he doesn't know how to treat Christians. Should he treat the elderly and the young in the same way? If they repent, are they free? Or is the fact that they were once Christians, is that enough? So he says, in the meanwhile, the method I have observed towards those who have been denounced to me as Christians is this. I interrogated them whether they were Christians. If they confessed it, I repeated the question twice again, adding the threat of capital punishment. If they still persevered, I ordered them to be executed. For whatever the nature of their creed might be, I could at least feel no doubt that contumacy and inflexible obstinacy deserved chastisement. Okay, so Pliny gives us an excellent example of the sufferings of the Christians at that time. Right? That merely for being a Christian, whether they had a crime associated with them or not, they were finished. So, in any case, in this letter, Pliny writes to the emperor, so that's point number 3 there on your handout. He said, "For the matter seemed to me well worth referring to you, especially considering the numbers endangered. Persons of all ranks and ages and of both sexes are and will be involved in the prosecution." In other words, there's a huge number of Christians, once again, in his area. "For this contagious superstition is not confined to the cities only, but has spread throughout the villages and rural districts. It seems possible, however, to check and cure it." Okay, so Pliny is confident that he can defeat this new religious movement. He says, "It is certain at least that the temples, which had been almost deserted, begin now to be frequented, and the sacred festivals, after a long intermission, are again revived." In other words, what is Pliny saying? He's saying that paganism was basically dying out in his area. Right? So once again, see how close this is to the life of Christ. It's only within 80 years of Christ's own life, and already way up, hundreds of kilometers away from Judea, Christianity is becoming the religion of the people up there. And the final one then is your final quote there, number 4 on this point, is from St. Luke, in fact, or St. Paul, if you like. So it's from Acts of the Apostles. So just to put this in context, Acts of the Apostles is really a story about the birth of the church and its first expansion. So it begins with the church having 120 members, and they all fit into one room around this size. Okay? So that's the entire Catholic Church could fit into the one room around this size. And then he shows how it expands outwards. So one of the little things that he says, what I'm sure a little chuckle, in point number 4 there, is Paul is on trial. He's in front of the king, Herod Agrippa. And Herod Agrippa is sort of saying, "I know nothing about what you're talking about." And Paul says, "Are you joking me? Everyone knows about this." And he says, "For the king knows about these things, and to him I speak freely, for I am persuaded that none of these things has escaped his notice, for this was not done in a corner." All right, so in other words, he's speaking about the expansion of Christianity. Everybody knows about it, and it wasn't something that would happen in secret and in private. No, the whole world knows about this by now. Okay, this all within a couple of decades of that moment when the church was all stuck in one room. Okay. Very good. So if that's our historical evidence for this huge explosion of Christianity in the first century, what might be the reasons? So I'd like to turn first from history to a consideration of causes by consideration of something more personal. We should take first a look at what it means to be human and how this responds then to the spread of Christianity. Because what is distinct about us as human beings is that we have brains that look for truth. And we have hearts that also look for love, in a sense that the animals don't. Okay, so the animals are all intelligent, right? If any of you has a dog or a cat, you know that they're intelligent. But our intelligence is on a different level. And what we do, is particularly as human beings, is we search for meaning. Isn't that right? Right? So when the cat chases the mouse or chases the bird, the cat doesn't stop to think, "Why am I doing this? Is it right or wrong? Right? Wasn't that bird doing nothing to me?" Okay, no, he just goes after the bird, right? Because that's his instinct. Whereas we think about it, right? And we think about the meaning of things and the question why. Of course, that's very dangerous for us because the ultimate why is up in the sky, right? The ultimate why is God himself. And then we have a heart as well that's built for love, okay? So a love that's not only self-serving, okay? So our dogs love us, right? Because we walk them and feed them and pat them, right? But we can love people even if they screech and cry and wake in the middle of the night and all these things, okay? So parents in particular who look after a child who's severely handicapped for years and years, what I would consider the most heroic example of ordinary Christian life, this shows us what human love is capable of. Okay, so I would like to say to you, and this will be one of the themes tonight, that Christianity expanded because it answered those questions of the desire of the human mind for truth, for meaning, and the desire of the human heart for goodness. Okay, so this being the Thomistic Institute, let's go straight to St. Thomas there. Quote number 5. He says, "Now, just as whatever is actually colored is the object of sight," okay, so in other words, if something has no color, we can't see it, Okay, that's easy enough, is it? Yeah. You all philosophers here? Just tonight? You're learning philosophy fast. Whatever is actually colored is the object of sight, so is good is the object of the will. In other words, what we want is always what's good. Isn't that right? Right? None of us wants what's bad. Right? Even the murderer, when he murders somebody, is looking for something good, whether it be power or revenge or something like that. What he would consider as being justice, whatever. So the will is always looking for what's good. Wherefore, if the will be offered an object which is good universally and from every point of view, the will tends to it of necessity. So we must want it if it's good in every way. If it wills anything at all, since it cannot will the opposite. On the other hand, the will is offered an object that is not good. If the will is offered an object that is not good from every point of view, it will not tend to it of necessity. And since lack of any good whatsoever is a non-good, consequently that good alone which is perfect and lacking in nothing is such a good that the will cannot will it, and this is happiness. Okay, so without going in too much into that, into the details, just look at two things St. Thomas says there, which I'm sure you'll agree with, which is that we will what is good. We want what is good. Is that fair enough? Okay, and ultimately what we want is happiness. Right? That if we want anything else in the way, such as power or control or food or sleep or pleasure or friends, it's all in the service of happiness. All right? So the will looks for happiness. Likewise, the intellect aims at truth. Point number 6. He says there, now the end of each thing is that which is intended by its first author or mover. But the first author and mover of the universe is an intellect, a mind, as will be later shown. So God is an intellect, a thinking spirit. The ultimate end of the universe must therefore be the good of an intellect. This good is truth. Truth must consequently be the ultimate end of the whole universe, and the consideration of the wise man aims principally at truth. Okay, so what he's saying is that if we're wise, then we want to know what is true. All right? And he goes on, elsewhere he says, the first reference of being to the intellect, in other words, what exists. So the intellect is our minds. Is that all right? And the first reference of being, that is what exists, to what's in here, in our minds, is that being, what exists, should agree with the mind. Okay, a little bit of Latin there. This agreement is called the conformity of thing and intellect. In this conformity is fulfilled the formal constituent of the true. And this is what the true adds to being, namely the conformity or equation of thing and intellect. Okay, so just to go through that again. What do you mean by something being true? Okay, we mean that it's real. Okay? But there's more to it than it being real. It means that it's real and my mind knows it. Okay? So it's true for me because my mind knows what's real. Is that fair enough? Right? So it's not rocket science. Okay? When we actually know this. Okay, so we put words in it, and the words seem strange, but we know this all the time. Okay, St. Augustine says a very useful thing to keep in our memories. He says, when he speaks of the mind being made for the truth, that our minds reach out for truth, he says, I have often wanted to lie, but I never wanted to be lied to. All right, so I never wanted anybody to tell me anything except the truth. Why? Because my mind is made for truth. Why? Because I'm a human being. Right, so as human beings, we reach out for happiness and we reach out for truth. All right, and it's in this context that we might take a look at the expansion of Christianity in the first century or in the first centuries. All right, so Christianity placed before the peoples of antiquity a claim to give them the object of their desires for the good and for the true. And this object was God, the good who never fails and the truth that is never found wanting. As Augustine stated, just as the Roman Empire was reaching its autumn days, he said there, that's quote number 7, you move us to delight in praising you. For you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. Okay, so you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. So how do we see that? We see that because we have hearts that reach out for happiness, and we have minds that reach out for truth. Okay, and God is the ultimate truth, the ultimate why, the ultimate answer to the question why, as truth, and the ultimate happiness as goodness. that God is the ultimate goodness. So Christianity, if it gave these answers and satisfied these desires, should therefore be contrasted with the belief systems it met, whether religious or philosophical. So, just to take a look at the competing belief systems in the Roman Empire, right? Do you know of any of them? I'm sure there are people here who know a lot more than I do about these things. Okay, so first of all, there were the pagan religions, and then there were the philosophies on top of that. Now, also, there is a very prominent Jewish community right throughout the empire, even though they would have been even more prominent in the east, outside the borders of the empire. But they were big in the empire, too. Good. So paganism, really, and philosophy are the two things that dominate the empire into which Christianity moves when it moves away from Judaism towards the more general population of the Roman Empire. Now, if any of you wants to take a look at the lingering effects of paganism and how strong the claims of paganism were, you could read St. Paul in the first letter to the Corinthians. And in the first letter to the Corinthians, he's after converting these people, but, and this is a consolation to every priest, he did a bad job of it, right? And what he does, what he has to write back to them, because they're basically still half pagan, right? And you see this by the fact that they still frequent prostitutes, they still go to pagan temples for the ceremonies, they still, if they have disputes among themselves, instead of keeping it within the church, which is only a small number of people at this time, they take it to the secular courts and things like that. So Paul writes back to them about all these things. And you can see how paganism still lingers in their hearts. So we often dismiss the paganism of the Greek world and the Roman world. But for them, naturally, it was very strong. Okay, and it was strong for them because this is what their cultures were all about. And their families were all about it, and so on and so forth. Okay, so what was it then that allowed Christianity to triumph over this? What was it that made Christianity more attractive to the people than their native paganism? So, this paganism, by the way, will have a very interesting future in the second century, because as Christianity moves into the Greek Empire, or into the Roman Empire and to Greek culture, that is throughout the Roman Empire, you get a mixture of Christianity and paganism, and it's what we call Gnostic Christianity. Okay? And if you wanted to become a Christian in the second century, at certain points, you'd look at these two types of Christianity, what we now call Orthodox Christianity, and this Gnostic Christianity, and you really wouldn't know necessarily which was the right one. Okay, so it's just the great Christian writers of the second century then who beat back Gnosticism and cleanse Christianity of this pagan, these pagan lingering facets to it. Okay, so Greek mythology and Roman religion alongside it still possess great power and will continue to do so for several centuries. Even in the 5th century, 400 years later, 450 years later, let's say, St. Augustine, after the collapse in the Roman Empire, still has to write to defend Christianity against the claim that it was the abandonment of paganism that brought about this collapse. Okay? And this is where he writes his famous book, The City of God, okay, in response to this idea that Christianity caused the collapse of the Roman Empire. Paul likewise witnesses in 1 and 2 Corinthians to the hold which Greek-Roman religion and the mystery cults from the East had on the Roman mind, as does St. Luke's amusing account. At least I find it amusing. Paul and Barnabas, they go into a city called Lystra. And in Lystra, Paul works a miracle. And next thing, the people in Lystra bring along a great big oxen. And it's garlanded with flowers, and they're going to sacrifice the oxen to Paul. Because they think that Paul must be the god Hermes if he's worked this miracle. And Barnabas, his companion, therefore must be Zeus. Okay, so it's all there in Acts of the Apostles chapter 14. So the poor oxen nearly paid a price for Paul's good works. And similarly, we read in Ephesus in Acts 19 how Paul, because he was converting the pagans, Ephesus was a big shrine of the goddess Artemis, right? And her temple was one of the biggest and one of the seven wonders of the world. And there are all these people making souvenirs Okay, little silver shrines and silver models of Artemis. And when Paul began to convert the people to Christianity, the silversmiths started to riot, right? Because they were losing business. It's all there. It's all very modern, isn't it? Right, so in any case, the search for an alternative understanding was already centuries old by this time in Greece. So the philosophers already, around the year 400 BC, had already begun to reject the mythological religion of the gods, okay, of Zeus and so on and so forth, and to replace it with a much more sophisticated idea of God. But nonetheless, if you got many gods, it's no problem at all to add a few more. Is that right? So every emperor proclaimed himself a god, right? I'd like to do that myself, but there'd be a problem. There's only one god, all right? And it was no problem that there could be this extra god, right? It didn't require that the emperor actually believed he was a god, right? He could still get the cold and get a flu and so on and so forth. But it was all part of culture, all part of the structure of society as well. Okay, so in that sense, the Christians were killed if they did not burn incense to the image of the emperor in the various cities around the empire. All right. Okay. So why Christianity spread so rapidly and so successfully requires a different answer for those who were educated and for the lower classes of artisans and slaves. So I want to divide this talk by those who were persuaded by goodness and those who were persuaded by truth. In other words, I'm going to pretend for a second that the lower classes of the artisans were persuaded by goodness, and the upper classes, the intellectual people, the university students, and so on and so forth, were persuaded by truth. Okay? Realizing, of course, that there's no real division between the two of them. Okay? So, important to take a look, first of all, is the slaves. So Christianity spread, so it seems, according to what we know from the presence of Christians in, for example, inscriptions on tombs or in writings or mentions of saints or so on and so forth, spread along the trade routes. Okay, and in particular, you'll be glad to know the trade in wine. Right? So the Christians were good at their wines from the very beginning. All right? Now, so who's spreading Christianity? It's the young fellas on the boat who are moving the cartons of wine here and there. And when they meet and they're talking with people, they're telling them about, you know what I've heard, right? And this is how Christianity is spreading. Okay, so it's a little bit of the lower classes at the beginning as well. So it might be the merchants as well, the upper classes who own the boats, but it's also the workers, right? So in Ireland too, if you look at the earliest saints who are credited with bringing the church to Ireland, it's in the southeast in Waterford with Declan, and in Wexford with Ebar. These are what we call pre-patrician saints. So they're before Patrick. And where are they? They're in the parts of the country nearest to the continent. Okay, so once again, it's probably the traders who brought Christianity first here in little bits before Patrick came with his bang. All right, and what did these ordinary people, these lower class people, find in Christianity? Well, just to take a look at this, I want to go to the very end of our time period, which is the 360s, or towards the end of our time period, which is the 360s, so move forward a few centuries. It's your point number 8 there, and it's from the Emperor Julian. Now, the Emperor Julian was raised as a Christian. Okay, so by this stage, in the early 300s, the emperor had, Constantine, first of all, had converted to Christianity. Okay? Then he was succeeded by Constantius. Was it by Theodosius then? Or no, Theodosius later. But by Constantius' nephew, Julian. And Julian, because Constantius had been such an evil man, though a Christian, went back to paganism. And he tried to revive the pagan gods across the Roman Empire. All right, so we call him Julian the Apostate. And in the year 362, as he's heading off towards the east to fight the Persians, and in fact he's going to die in the battle there, he writes a letter to one Arsacius, who's high priest in Galatia, about the restoration of the temple of the goddess Cybele in the city of Pessinus, And he writes on the needs of the pagan priests that you must imitate the Christians in your charity. So he says there, the Hellenic religion or the Greek religion does not yet prosper as I desire, and it is the fault of those who profess it. For the worship of the gods is on a splendid and magnificent scale, surpassing every prayer and every hope. And then he goes on. He says, and this is your quote there on number 8, why then do we think that this is enough? Why do we not observe that it is their benevolence to strangers? Okay, in other words, the Christians' kindness to strangers, their care for the graves of the dead, and the pretended holiness of their lives that have done most to increase atheism. Okay, so atheism is what he calls Christianity, right? Funnily enough, right? Because they didn't worship the gods. Okay, at one stage, in the previous century, St. Polycarp in Smyrna is being put to death, and the crowds are saying, down with the atheists! And Polycarp says, yes, up with the atheists! Right? So they kill him. Great. All right. He says, in any case, I believe that we ought really and truly to practice every one of these virtues, for it is disgraceful that when no Jew has ever has to beg, and the impious Galileans, that's another word for the Christians, support not only their own poor, but ours as well, all men see that our people lack aid from us. Okay, so you see the point there? That Julian, even though he wants to destroy Christianity, nonetheless admits that these people are phenomenally charitable, right? That they're charitable not only towards their own people, which the Jews already were, but even to the pagans as well. All right? So this is something we see constantly in Christianity, even way back in the letter to the Galatians. St. Paul goes up to Jerusalem. He meets Peter, James, and John up there. Peter and James and John say, yes, you're doing a great job. And Paul says, so they gave us the right hand of communion, but they asked us one thing, which was not to forget the poor. And Paul says, and this, in any case, I was anxious to do, right? Not to forget the poor. In the middle of the second century, St. Justin Martyr writes to the emperor, Marcus Aurelius, I think, who we all know from Gladiator, right? Writes to the emperor about Christianity, more or less trying to persuade the emperor not to persecute them, and better still to convert and to become a Christian. And in it, he speaks about the Eucharist, and he speaks how the Christians gather together every Sunday morning, and he speaks of the bread and wine and the water that's added to the wine, and so on. And he says, this food is called among us Eucharistia, the Eucharist, of which no one is allowed to partake but the man who believes that the things which we teach are true. But he also mentions, he goes on then to say, and the wealthy among us help the needy, and we always keep together. And for all things wherewith we are supplied, we bless the Maker of all through his Son, Jesus Christ, and through the Holy Spirit. And they who are well-to-do and willing give what each thinks fit, and what is collected is deposited with the president, or the one who presides, who helps the orphans and the widows and those who through sickness and other cause are in want, and so on, those in prison, etc. All right. So at the same time then, or a little later, there's another man by the name of Tertullian, who's one of the great Christian fighters, right? Fighter with the pen. And he writes as well. He says, on the monthly day, if he likes, each puts a small donation, but only if it be his pleasure, and only if he be able, for there is no compulsion, all is voluntary. These gifts are, as it were, piety's deposit fund, and so on. Okay, so that's he's describing the Christian charity there. Point number 9 for you in your handout there is actually by a satirist, okay, who's a pagan, and he writes satire. That's how he makes his money and his fame. His name is Lucian of Samosata. And one of the stories that he writes a satire about is this man called Peregrinus. Okay, so you see down there at the corner of page 1, The Passing of Peregrinus is the book. And Peregrinus is what we call a philosopher, a cynic philosopher. He becomes a Christian. Then he decides eventually not to be a Christian. And he decides that the best thing to do is to commit suicide. Okay, so this is what the story is about. And Lucian writes a great big satire on this stupid man, Peregrinus. Okay, but in any case, he speaks about him becoming a Christian. And he says about the Christians, when Peregrinus is thrown into prison for professing Christianity, he says, they show incredible speed whenever any such public action is taken, for in no time they lavish their all. So it was then in the case of Peregrinus, much money came to him from them by reason of his imprisonment, and he procured not a little revenue from it. The poor wretches have convinced themselves, first and foremost, that they are going to be immortal and live for all time, in consequence of which they despise death and even willingly give themselves into custody, most of them. So if any charlatan and trickster comes, he quickly acquires sudden wealth by imposing it upon simple folk. Okay, so Lucian is laughing at the Christians for the fact that they're so generous with their money. And he says, all you need to do is become a Christian and you'll be rich in no time. Right? End up in prison, so much the better, and they'll give you all their wealth. Right? But these people are witnessing, like Julian and Lucian, who are against the Christian faith or uninterested, witnessing to an incredible culture of charity. So one of the ways in which this was expressed was with slaves. So slaves made up, I think, about 1 in 8 of the population of Rome, okay, of the Roman Empire. Now, nobody thought that slavery should be abolished. Okay, abolishing slavery for them was like abolishing people who work in Lidl for us. Okay, they simply said, some people work like that. Okay, that's the way things are. Right? And it never occurred to them that there was anything wrong with it. It's also worth saying that slavery was very different in the Roman Empire from what it became in, for example, what we're familiar with in the American South. Okay, that a slave was rarely whipped and so on and so forth. They're just part of the household. Nonetheless, what Christianity brings to the table with the slaves, to the slaves, is a sense of their dignity. And we see there, so point number 10 there on your handout is quite a late quote. So this is Gregory of Nyssa writing towards the end of the 300s. Okay, so if we're still in the first century, this is a little bit on. So Gregory of Nyssa is the first among the Christians to publicly say that slavery should be abolished. Okay, so that quote there is from Tom Holland, a recent historian, but he's quoting Gregory, who says, not all the world would constitute an adequate payment for the soul of a mortal. He said, and added to that, that to own slaves, quote, was to set one's own power above God's. All right, so before Gregory, Christians didn't call for the abolition of slavery, but what they did do was that they told the masters that your slaves are the same as you in the eyes of God. They might be different in this world, they might have different work to do in this world, but in the eyes of God, they are the same. Okay, so we see this in... This has not been completely absent, right? Seneca, a Roman politician, writes the same things, that the slave is my brother. Right, but I'm just going to give you a few quotes there from the Bible, from the New Testament, which are not on your handout. Okay, so first of all, St. Paul writing to Philemon. Philemon is a slave owner. His slave Onesimus has run away, and he's joined with Paul. And now Paul is going to send him back to his master. Right, and he writes to Philemon. He says, perhaps this is why he was parted from you for a while, that you might have him back forever. No longer as a slave, but more than a slave, as a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you, both in the flesh and in the Lord. Okay, so in other words, he's saying to this slave owner that he's your brother in Christ, your brother in the Lord. In Colossians, St. Paul says, slaves, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not pleasing their eyes as men pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing the Lord. He says, whatever your task, work heartily as serving the Lord and not men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. So in other words, he's saying that the slaves are no longer just stupid people who are better for good for nothing except working. No, they are servants of Christ themselves, and that all their work will have a reward. So the slaves then become quite big in the Roman Empire. I'm not going to delay now because I'm running out of time. You'll be glad to know. So in the quote I gave you there earlier on, 10 minutes, thank you very much. Quote I gave you there earlier on, who did I quote earlier on? Yes, from Pliny when he's writing to the emperor, wondering what he should do with the Christians. He writes about two women slaves, and he says, I couldn't find out anything wrong about these Christians, so I tortured two women slaves who were deaconesses, right? So in other words, they have status within the church, even though they're women and slaves, all right? There's another very famous account of the martyrdom of the Christians in Lyon, in France, in which one of the great writers of the second century, St. Irenaeus, died as well. And Tom Holland, in his book Dominion, points out that one of the key figures in this is a slave woman again, a lady by the name of Blandina. And even though the account mentions that her mistress also was put to death, the mistress is unnamed, but the slave is named. Okay, so you see, completely different atmosphere, right? So slaves are still slaves, and yet there's a completely different sense of their value and their worth. In women as well, hate to say this, but when you think that in Roman society, the women were the property of their husbands, all of a sudden you see in the writings of the New Testament something different. So St. Peter writes this, likewise you husbands, he says, live considerately with your wives, bestowing honor on the woman as the weaker sex. Since, he says, you are joint heirs of the grace of life. Okay, so in other words, the woman is no longer property, but she is joint heir in the grace of Christ. And then St. Paul goes on to say, remember now that in the Roman society, the women, the children, all belong, are the property of the husband. Okay, but he says, for the wife does not rule over her own body, but the husband does. Okay, very good. But then he says something which is completely revolutionary. He says, likewise, the husband does not rule over his own body, but the wife does. All right, so once again, there's a complete flip in the understanding of marriage there in particular. Okay, along with that. So I just wanted to move you back up there to point number 11. Once again, Tom Holland, he says, Paul, by proclaiming the body a temple of the Holy Spirit, was not merely casting a sacrilege attitudes towards sex that most men in Corinth or Rome took for granted. He was also giving to those who serviced them, the bar girls and the painted boys and brothels, the slaves used without compunction by their masters, a glimpse of salvation. To suffer as Christ had done, to be beaten and degraded and abused, was to share in his glory. Okay? So there's no social revolution taking place here, and yet the status, the value that people can see in themselves is completely changed. Right, so in that sense, if we were saying, why did the lower classes, the tradesmen, the artisans, and so on and so forth, become Christians? Well, they're given a whole new vision of themselves, right, that was never present in pagan society. All right. The intellectual. Point number 13 there is a quote. Now, it's way, way back. It's way in the 7th century from the Iliad. And this is Zeus. For on this wise have the gods spun the thread for wretched mortals, says Homer, that they should live in pain. The mortals should live in pain. That's us. And they themselves are sorrowless. For two urns are set upon the floor of Zeus of gifts that he gives, the one of ills, the other of blessings. To whomsoever Zeus who hurls the thunderbolt gives a mingled lot, that man meets now with evil, now with good. Okay? In other words, this is what pagan religion believes about the gods, okay, that they're sometimes giving us good, sometimes giving us evil. All right? Why do they believe this? Because there is good and evil in the world. Okay, so they extrapolate from that quite naturally up to the idea that the gods themselves. It's very revolutionary then that St. John the Evangelist, in his first letter, will say, after speaking about 3 years with Christ, whom we have heard and we've seen, who we touched with our own hands and watched with our own eyes. And he says, and this is what we have learned from him, and tell you that God is light. In him there is no darkness at all. All right, so completely different vision of God from that of the pagans, where Zeus was sometimes giving out evil, sometimes giving out goods, completely unthinking, unfeeling. No, for the Christian, God is light. In him there is no darkness at all. Point number 14. Is a discourse. Could you see there? It's by a fellow called Dio Chrysostom, right? Who lives in the end of the first century. Okay, those dates are obviously wrong because they say that he lived to be 115. All right, that can't be correct. Nonetheless, must beat up my secretary when I go home. He says, in any case, to find a man who in plain terms, Greek katharos terms, clean terms, and without guile, adolos, speaks his mind with frankness, parezi adzomenon, okay, so parezi is boldness, and neither for the sake of reputation, doxis, nor for gain, but out of good will and concern for his fellow men, stands ready, if need be, to submit to ridicule and to the disorder and the uproar of the mob. To find such a man as that is not easy, but rather the good fortune of a very lucky city. So great is the dearth of noble, independent souls, and such the abundance of toadies, colicon, mountebanks, and sophists. Ha. Okay, so he sees himself as being sent by God. Right? Now, the reason why I have that in there is that if I had more time, I would say to you that when St. Paul writes his first letter to the Thessalonians, and St. Paul is writing a lot earlier, so Diocristian would only have been a teenager when St. Paul wrote his first letter to the Thessalonians, he writes with almost exactly the same, well, he writes with several of similar words, okay, and the same theme. So, Diocristian belonged to a group of philosophers called the Cynics, okay, who were very popular at the time. Now, cynicism for the Greeks is different from cynicism for us, and it was for them was people who do not care about society, okay? So sometimes they would walk around naked or dirty or whatever, and they would have no interest in what people think because they're independent thinkers, right? Bit extreme, as you can imagine, right? But St. Paul as well, he says in 1 Thessalonians, he says, "You know yourselves, brothers and sisters, that our coming to you was not in vain. But though we had already suffered and been shamefully treated in Philippi, as you know, we had courage." So the same word, parousia, in our God, to declare to you the gospel of God in spite of great opposition. For our appeal does not spring from deceit or impure motives. Akatharsis, so that word katharos in Diocristian, Paul uses it too. And so on and forth. Or trickery, dolo, as Diocristian uses, adolos. So my point here really is to say that the Christians speak very philosophically a lot of the time. And this is what we don't realize when we read the New Testament, if you read the New Testament, is that there's quite a philosophical background in it. Now, the point is not to say that Paul was a philosopher. The point was really to say that when Paul wrote to these people, who themselves would have a philosophical background, being good Greeks, good Romans, he was trying to say that what you're looking for in philosophy, we have. That Christ has brought a wisdom which you yourselves have been searching for in philosophy. All right, so we see this as well in what's called Stoicism, which is another of the great philosophies of the time, very popular. And Stoicism was based on the idea of self-sufficiency, right? And Paul refers to that in 1 Corinthians twice, he mentions, or 2 Corinthians twice, he mentions self-sufficiency, that this is enough for me, and so on and so forth, okay? What we also see is, your point number 15 there is a quote from St. John's Gospel. Right, so why do you think the Stoics were called the Stoics? They were called the Stoics because they used to meet under the Stoa, which is the portico in, I don't know what city, whatever. And the Aristotelians were called the Peripatetics because they used to walk up and down. Okay, and see what St. John says about Jesus here in number 15. He says it was the feast of the dedication at Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was walking up and down, right? Periepate, in the temple, in the portico, in the Stoa of Solomon. And who's Solomon? He's the king of wisdom, right? So you can see here how Jesus, or St. John is taking to Jesus both the title of the Aristotelians and the Stoics as well, that Jesus is the great philosopher. All right, in that sense. Now, two more people that I'm going to mention in the next 60 seconds. All right. we're in go away. So, first of all, the classic case of conversion is Justin Martyr. So Justin Martyr in the middle of the first century, he's a philosopher, and he speaks very beautifully. He writes a work called The Apology to Trypho, or The Dialogue with Trypho the Jew. And he speaks about being a philosopher, that he tried different philosophers, and none of them really was convincing. until he met an old man by the sea. And the old man started to speak to him about reincarnation, which is also a theme in Socrates and Plato, and convinced him. But what's interesting in Justin is that he's looking for happiness. So he's looking for truth and he's looking for happiness. And this is in Christianity that he finds it. So Justin becomes what we call the first Christian philosopher. And so just moving on to Ireland there, because I'm out of time. When St. Patrick came to Ireland, okay, we're not sure of the dates exactly, but he himself had huge success. Okay, as we see there from a quote from his Confessions, number 17 there. Hence, how did it come to pass in Ireland that those who never had a knowledge of God, but until now always worshipped idols and things impure, have now been made a people of the Lord and are called sons and daughters of God, and the sons and daughters of the kings of the Irish are seen to be monks and virgins of Christ. Okay, and he speaks elsewhere in paragraph 14 of his Confessions of having baptized thousands of people. Okay, so when we think of St. Patrick as this major missionary, he was actually. And he had a great reception in this country. And why? So what I'd refer you to there is point number 18, is this author by the name of Thomas Cahill, who wrote a book deliciously entitled How the Irish Saved Civilization. Yay. Okay. Apparently he also wrote a book called How the Jews Saved Civilization. So that sort of undermines his credibility a little bit. Right? But in this, he goes through the Irish myths and legends from beforehand, especially the Tonbo Cooley, right? The cattle raid of Cooley. And this is what he says at the end of it, having gone through all the witches and the evil spirits and so on and so forth. He says, beneath the bravado of this warrior society, constantly brandishing its flesh-destroying weapons, rumbles a quaking fear so acute that it can kill. The conscious indifference to death that is a hallmark of all the heroes of the Tonne masks a subconscious fear of death that no public rhetoric can erase. Patrick held out to these warrior children in his own person a living alternative. It was possible to be brave, to expect every day to be murdered, betrayed, enslaved, whatever may come my way. Okay, that's a quote from St. Patrick's own Confessions. And yet be a man of peace, at peace. All right. So one last point that I'm not going to go in yet to points number 19, 20, and 21 there because of time. But suffice to say that if we say the charity was a major factor in converting the peoples of the Roman Empire to Christianity, most especially those of the lower classes and those on the margins, so it was in Ireland too. And just as in the Roman Empire, it affected the women in a special way by raising the sense of the personal dignity of the person. So in Ireland as well, it was a woman. So St. Brigid is a person of immense historical importance in Ireland, because she is, more than anyone, who introduces the notion of charity. And she also has a huge outreach from her base in Kildare. Right? So I'm going to read a little quote for you there from this recent book by, or at least a chapter in a book by a lady called Catherine Swift. She says, common themes in the early hagiography of Brigid include an emphasis on her Christian faith, which enabled her to perform miracles, as well as pronounced interest in charity and hospitality, including miracles of fecundity in relation to the multiplication and preservation of food. There is a concern with chastity, but one which is marked by forgiveness for those who might have failed to adhere to it. And there is a relatively strong theme of obedience of women religious to their bishop. Sorry about that, ladies. But on the other hand, there are also episodes showing reciprocal episcopal care of female religious. For example, Bishop Mel provides support for Brigid when she is physically suffering. Bishop Ebar provides her with grain, and Bishop Brown came to visit her with gifts. And then they say, and this is worth keeping in mind, all the early vitae, or all the early lives, lay considerable emphasis on Brigid's travels across large parts of Ireland and her generous involvement in larger lay society. Okay, so there's another word in these early legends of Brigid, or these early lives of Brigid, there's a sense of her influencing people over a wide area. Okay, that she's not just located in her own little place. And what she really brings to the story of Ireland is that it's charity for all those who are in need, which has never, ever been seen before. Great. So I'm going to leave it at that. I think the theme of that is pretty clear, right? That the appeal to the mind and the appeal to the heart that Christianity was able to bring, and the sense of dignity as well that people had never come across before. These were the accepting ourselves from the supernatural power of the Holy Spirit. These were the winning traits by which Christianity enjoyed this incredible success, both in the first century in the Roman Empire and in the fifth century in Ireland as well. So thanks very much for your time. That was the longest 45 minutes we've ever had in our lives. So are there any...
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.